Concession number 17747, reel 22.
We had got down from the hills where I think, did I note the death of Colonel McCracken?
Yes, you mentioned that he'd been killed in action.
That's
on the
right.
Monte Camino.
Well, he'd been taken away with a piece of shrapnel in his eye, and together with also the same incident had killed one of the gunners and wounded two or three others. I noted that on 7th of December I visited the grave of the unfortunate signaller Ruddy and packed up the tactical headquarters. I'm trying to remember where we were at this time. Oh, it was still up in the hill.
But you then moved down, I think
then
you described a moonlit drive.
Yes, that's right. Oh, yes, we went to, we did a reconnaissance and moved to new positions in the area of 46th Division at a place called Sessa Arunca, near the coast.
Did you have a formal handover from 46th Division?
Well, it was formal in the sense that it happened and was ordered. The formality, of course, it would not be very great because we tended to know each other, and one gunner regiment knows how another one works. You take over the gun positions and so on.
Did they provide you with guides to lead you into the area where you can have your TAC headquarters and your gun positions?
I think that at that point we probably didn't have a TAC headquarters because there was a slight lull. We were already beginning to get into an established situation of the German winter line, the Gustav line. And there was an opportunity, I think, without having to do it in the middle of the heat of battle, to change places with 46th Division. I can't remember, unfortunately, what their gunner regiment was called. Ours was, of course, the 64th Field. I don't remember what theirs was.
Do you recall if you moved into positions that they had already occupied, or whether you actually dug your own in the same sort of area?
We took over theirs as far as possible because they would have dug themselves in. I don't mean literally, but in terms of knowing sources of eggs and chickens and all kinds of local knowledge which would be useful. I mean, you can short-circuit a lot of... you don't have to reinvent the wheel if you take over somebody else's wheel.
What about the tactical positions? I mean, do you remember if the 56th Division deployed in the same way as the 46th had, or whether there was a change of the pattern of deployment which would necessitate changing the location of your guns and their orientation?
I can't remember. That's the simple answer. I remember I have a sort of faint visual memory of being down on this coastal plain, down from the hills, and there being a battle pending, a battle to cross the Garigliano, and we made all the necessary arrangements for that. Whether we moved into a tactical headquarters, I'm not sure. I don't think we did, but we were ready for it. We knew a battle was coming. And this relative lull enabled the divisions to change places.
Now you mentioned that you had some casualties. You'd had the unfortunate signaller, Ruddy, and the colonel had died of his wounds after...
Well, yes, I didn't know that he'd died at this stage. We knew that he'd lost an eye, and so did his batman. Now, I've noted Saturday's... the 11th of December 43, we sent a recce party out to look for new positions, and we had Major Churchill acting as our commanding officer and possibly hoping to succeed Colonel McCracken, and we knew that Monte Camino had died down, that it was all peace there. Presumably, it was a no-win situation for either side.
So it had become a stalemate.
It had become more static. I'm just trying to orientate. We're still in the process of moving. Yes, it was a very mixed and muddled situation because I had a message, or the adjutant with whom I was working had a message to collect a new colonel at this point. And I was off like a shot and tore along in a staff car with driver to Naples and arrived in the dusk, put up at a transit hotel, and there was no colonel. But what a change from Monte Camino to have dinner in an officer's club with an orchestra and lights, and to be able to see Vesuvius glowing in the night over the floodlit harbour and the Bay of Naples. And this contrast went on the next day, glorious morning drive in Naples, go to the hospital, and I'm shocked to hear that Colonel McCracken died on Sunday. That would be the 12th of December. Give two Grenadier Guardsmen a lift back to our base at Sessa Arunca, our new regimental headquarters, and they went back into the front line. And I had had 24 hours break, but the new CO had not met me in Naples, and he turned up on his own, together with a personal bombardier added to the strength, and I think his own driver too, whom he was devoted to, and he carried, these two people tended to go round with him.
What was he supposed to have done? Was he supposed to have simply made himself known to you at the hotel?
Yes, I was supposed to meet him at the hotel and take him back to the regiment.
And he hadn't turned up.
But
while
he came
were there.
In his own car, and presumably that would have to be taken back because it would be extra to establishment. Why he did this, I don't know, but he tended to be slightly a law unto himself.
What was he like, this new commanding officer? How did he compare to Colonel McCracken?
Totally, utterly different. He was had been a horse riding regular Royal Artillery person. I don't remember. I think he was fairly short of stature. He astonished some of us by turning up in riding breeches and sort of high boots. My feeling was, and I think it's probably true, that this was his first command in action. He had come from a staff job, I think.
How old was he when he took command?
How old? I could, no doubt the records would show in PRO, but when you're only 21, everybody seems old. I should think he must have been about late 30s, probably, perhaps even 40. He was not a young, dashing young colonel. He was a mature man. And that was that. And I sorted out Colonel McCracken's personal possessions and sent home to his widow through the whatever the usual channels were, most of his things, and kept as a memento something which I still have, his cutthroat razor, because he always used the cutthroat razor.
What happened to the colonel himself? Did you bury him?
No, we never saw or heard of him in the immediate sense again. I mean, he was buried in a military cemetery in the Naples area.
What happened to your casualties who actually were killed on the spot? Did you usually bury them, or were they sent off for disposal?
They were. We would bury them in an immediate situation if it was in an open site. I mean, they would be buried temporarily, and then their bodies would be collected by the war graves people or the Pioneer Corps, whoever was doing this. I was not familiar with it. I had, I suppose, some sort of aversion, as most people had, to knowing too much about these things. Although one or two of my colleagues who were not temporarily unattached or available had the wretched job of going out with spades and actually picking up the remains of people and putting them into sacks.
Who was actually responsible for notifying the fact and the location of these casualties up the chain of command? I presume this was an adjutant function.
Yes, that's right. It's part of the adjutant's office to let divisional headquarters know. I'm woefully inadequate about these things. I didn't administer them. I would let people know that this and that had happened, but I didn't have to do anything about it. These things were all arranged. I think some of this was the kind of RSM function. And we were more concerned, we had to be, about the ongoing battle rather than the admin arrangements. Whereas you had, say, old sweats. It's not quite like that, but I mean, you had people who knew from the age of 15 when they entered the service how these things happened, quartermasters and RSMs, and the sort of solid body of the ongoing army, who were less concerned with tactics and battles, but more concerned with how a regiment should be run in peacetime as well as in wartime.
How did you get on with your new colonel, this regular chap? Did he have the same kind of command style as McCracken?
I've noted that I think he used to be a battery commander, but I didn't know where. I've noted that we're in a smelly village. Somehow the people live. And I've put the colonel is an old-fashioned, intolerant, but cheerful type.
What was he intolerant of?
I think when you're a subaltern, the word intolerant comes easily, because you are a dog's body, and unless somebody is exceptionally generous, you do regard senior officers being slight bastards, because they're always demanding. They're like small children, or can be, always asking for this and that, and wanting service. I don't remember anything in particular about his requirements, but I've noted, and it's an interesting little thing in view of what you were saying a moment ago, I'd quite forgotten this, the batteries compete for making a cross for Colonel McCracken's grave. So we obviously made a cross. I'm minded of that by having seen in Salisbury Cathedral only a few days ago crosses made for various purposes by battalions of the Wiltshire Regiment. There are rumours about the division going home. This probably means nothing. The front is quiet, as indeed it was, hence this fairly peaceful takeover from 46th Division. Patrols, noise of distant shelling.
How far away were you from the enemy in this new area you'd taken over from 46th Division?
I would have thought about 3-4, possibly even 5 miles. It was it's easily identified on the map. It was the coastal plain leading up to the Garigliano River, and Sessa Arunca, near where we were, was a sort of spur of rock with a good forward observation.
Over the river valley?
Over the river valley, not the river itself, which of course had trees and so on, but a fair distance from a not very high little hill or little plateau leading up the coast.
What could you see looking forward?
Well, rather like looking over the English Fen District. Mm. It's slightly not quite so bare as that.
So it's a floodplain, flattish floodplain. Was it intersected by ditches? And
yes, wadis, ditches, drainage, canals. Mm. This, one mustn't forget, of course, this was the sort of pre-Mussolini, highly malarial country.
Not cultivated.
It was well cultivated. It was quite fertile, but it had to be drained properly to make it so. This is what, between Naples and Rome, obviously there were markets for produce in ordinary peacetime from Naples to the south, Rome in the north, and it was desirable property agriculturally, horticulturally, provided it was properly looked after, and I should think that Mussolini's people had helped it to get drained just as they'd helped the railways to run.
And the village you mentioned,
yes.
You say it was very smelly. What else?
Well, it's lack of adequate drains. They're fairly primitive, the living conditions of these people. I mean, I don't know what the cesspit situation was, but people they were quite simply peasants, very nice, simple people, but they were living in a state of public amenity, which was probably sort of 100 years behind what one had been used to at home.
Well, I mean, was the architecture the same as it had been further up in the mountains? Were there significant differences in there?
I wouldn't have thought they were significant, except that you probably had all flat roofs. There was not the same need to protect against snow and wind as you would get on the up in Monte Camino area.
So the climate was milder?
Yes, it was simply warmer because it was lower. Which didn't mean that it wasn't pretty damn cold. I was attending this during this lull. I was attending a 167 Brigade Intelligence Officers Conference every day.
Yes.
And
how many people would be at that conference?
Well, there would be one each from the battalions. And gunners 4 or 5, and there would be obviously more from there'd be somebody from divisional headquarters. Mm. I would have thought it was a small conference of half a dozen or so, being briefed by brigade major at brigade level.
Do you remember what sort of information he was bringing to the conference?
No, I don't. I made no notes, of course, about this kind of thing. I have no idea. No doubt we were being briefed on the Gustav line and the high strategy, and we hadn't at this stage heard anything about what was obviously being planned, and that was the Anzio bridgehead.
Apart from going to these daily conferences, how else were you occupied during this relatively quiet period?
Well, I don't know quite where the adjutant was, but I've noted that in the week leading up to Christmas, 20th of December, a very hard day doing all the work of IO, intelligence officer, as well as adjutant for the day, attend a brigade conference. Russians begin their attack on Vitebsk, and the batteries are making their crosses for Colonel McCracken. Harassing day, and then find myself on night duty. And that night, I heard out of the blue that I'm going to be given some leave from tomorrow with two people from the batteries. I was in RHQ, but Captain Wellman and Lieutenant Hodge from two different batteries were going on leave with me. And I feel very excited about this. And Major Churchill he's the second in command, receives a message about another military cross for him from the North African campaign. I think he'd already had more recently one from Salerno, and this was back to North Africa some months earlier.
So he had
the military cross.
A double MC,
yes. Mm. Next morning, 22nd December, off at 7 o'clock to Naples in rain in a leaking truck. Have a bit of fun at the officers' club in Naples, and then whilst we were having lunch, we backed, I remember very well, we backed this 1,500 weight truck up to a wall so that it couldn't be easily got into. But nonetheless, when we came out from lunch, my best greatcoat, my prized possession, had gone from this sealed truck whilst we were having lunch. Eventually, we made our way to the Leave Hotel in Sorrento, we were staying at what I think was probably the best hotel in Sorrento, the Vittoria, on top of a cliff in the town centre. Nearly all the fellow guests there were Americans, it being a Fifth Army officers' hotel. Go to a dance at the convalescent depot, meet British nurses, Christmas atmosphere. Something I don't remember the detail of at all, but I had obviously been given some stuff to take the late Captain Scott's kit to depot. One had these little odd informal arrangements. If somebody was going somewhere, they would do things other than the main purpose. The main purpose was leave, but I was given the job of taking this man's kit back to depot. I don't remember Captain Scott at all. I don't think I ever met him.
Was he presumably in one of the other batteries?
Yes, that's
you had
right.
Not served?
That's right. He would be.
What had happened to him? Do you know?
Well, I don't know. I'm looking at the. As we speak, I'm just casting my eye on the. No, we're not quite there. December the 4th, yes. This is the. Regimental history, a very short document, and that would be premature. The that's right. Some crazy Yanks take us out to dinner in a large jeep with an Italian countess among others. They end up by breaking up a drinking dive after we've restrained them from assaulting the proprietor's wife. I think you asked me last time what
you said
contact
that
I'd had with
one
Americans.
Of the Americans went wild and had
yes,
to be
that's right.
Restrained.
That's right. We had a hair-raising drive along the I don't know whether you know it, the winding cliff road.
Corniche Road.
Yes, that's right. From Sorrento around to Positano. 24th, Christmas Eve, up early and across by boat to Capri, the most unpleasant rowing boat in a rough sea to the Blue Grotto. As I can't swim, I change boats rather than go through the tiny hole into the Blue Grotto. I felt cowardly. On the other hand, having survived 3 months of the Germans, I determined not to drown on Christmas Eve. Then we had a cab round parts of the beautiful island, and I found myself in a curio shop alongside another customer whose face I vaguely recognised from photographs. It was General Eisenhower.
What was he up to?
He was buying mementos, as I was.
Did you speak to him?
No.
Did he speak to you?
No. No. No, he looked a quiet, modest chap, and he was doing his shopping.
You didn't feel inspired to ask him how the war was going or what he was intending to make of your
fate? I'm trying to remember what his situation was at this time. I think he'd probably just taken over from Alexander. I think he took over from Alexander, I'm not sure. No, I've quite forgotten what his position was. I mean, obviously, he was... not long there, because he was back preparing for the Second Front in no time at all. He may indeed have been doing a visit to the Middle East forces as part of his a roving commission before concentrating on the Second Front.
Before becoming Supreme Allied Commander.
Yes, that's right. He may have been talking to people about the landings to take place in southern France as well as the Second Front. I don't know. However, all this was bliss compared with the war. have rides around parts of the Capri and take a funicular and see the sunset and so on. Dance again with the nurses at the convalescent depot, carol singing. 25th, Christmas, great day, best one could have hoped for away from home. Up late, write letters, post heaps of parcels, colossal Christmas dinner with olives, turkey, ice cream, etc.
Was this at your hotel?
This was at the hotel, the Vittoria in Sorrento. Spent 4 nights there. That was the leave allocation. It was the standard practice. People took it in turns.
Can I ask what you'd found to send home in parcels?
Yes, you can. I remember vividly because I sent my mother a set of a small decanter and a set of liqueur glasses, and I sent her also a coral necklace. There was quite a lot of coral made up into necklaces. I remember this so vividly because when I got home, my parents had stuck together the totally smashed decanter and glasses, which had been broken en route, and bits of the coral had come off. The parcels tended to be treated, we thought, rather roughly, and in effect, it was a waste of time. The whole lot had been smashed. I think I sent a girlfriend, I'm not sure, a silk scarf from there. There was silk available in southern Italy.
Presumably that would have done rather better.
That would do better because, yes, that's right.
Not so fragile.
That's right. There was a display by Tarantella dancers in the hotel in the evening. I remember this very well because when I went back with Janet 12 years later, the same people were doing the same thing. Exactly the same people. I met a nurse who'd been in Northern Ireland, and everybody was very merry, and we had a magnificent time, and saw the nurses back to their nurse residence at about 3:30 a.m. Totally tired, packed, squared our accounts. We had to pay for drinks and extras.
Presumably these nurses were army nurses.
Yes.
They were not civilians.
Oh, not civilians. No, they were, what would it be?
Queen Alexander's,
that's right.
Royal Army Nursing
that's
Corps.
That's right, that's right, that's right. Oh, yes. And we filled ourselves first thing in the morning with, bottles of brandy back in the 1500 weight truck. Called on the nurses on the way just to wave goodbye before going on to Naples and had dinner at the officers' club. Eventually got back to the regiment at 1 a.m. No greatcoat any longer. Tired, but having had a good time.
But were you able to replace your greatcoat? Did you get another one issued?
I had got an issue one in place of a superb Regent Street, Hector Power one, which I had issued at Alton Towers, I suppose only, it seems 9 years, but it was only 9 months before, in when I was being measured up for uniforms and things. One of the orders I put in was for a greatcoat, which was part of the cash entitlement at Alton Towers. So I'd had this greatcoat beautifully tailored, a lovely garment, for about 9 months before I lost it. And it was replaced by an ordinary issue greatcoat from the quartermaster.
Not a very good exchange.
Not a very good exchange, no.
You also mentioned going out in a jeep with the Americans.
Yes.
And I think earlier on you'd mentioned that jeeps were beginning to appear.
Yes.
Did you get jeeps issued to the regiment?
Yes, we did, but not, if I remember rightly, quite at this stage. They would have come through by degrees. It may be that the colonel had one, or that we had one or two, and possibly a battery commander had one, but not at this stage. I was more conscious of jeeps when we came back later in 1944 to Northern Italy after had our recuperation stint in Egypt, which we can mention. This is when jeeps became the norm, and I don't remember 1500 weight trucks being having seen any or having mentioned any after that time.
So this happened later on.
It was a gradual replacement. Mm. Yes, that's right. Of course, it made sense to have jeeps, because they, being American, they were left-hand drive, whereas all of our 1500 weight trucks
were
right-hand drive. And since everybody was driving on the right, it made obvious sense, quite apart from the sheer convenience of the jeeps, which were wonderful little things to so manoeuvrable and so strong.
Sounds as though they were a distinct improvement over the utilities.
Oh, no doubt, no doubt at all. No doubt about that. They could be covered, but they were mainly open, whereas the 1500 weight had cover. Some of them had permanent cover, others had canvas cover.